couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films, The Outfit, Deep Water, Panama, Master, and The Last Days of Ptolemy Gray. I'm also going to be talking about the news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Nightmare. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The big news of the week I want to loop back and talk about was the 27th Annual Critics' Choice Awards, which happened on Sunday night. And there were big wins for Power of the Dog, Mitchell versus the Machines, and Belfast. I loved all of those movies. There's other ones that won certain awards, like Licorice Pizza, that piece of crap won something. But, you know, it was The Power of the Dog that was really impressive, mainly because this sets the stage to possibly get an Oscar win. And this is something that Netflix has been going after for several years lately, all the way going back to Roma and then The Irishman. They want to be that first streaming service to win an Oscar for the best picture. And they got a really good shot with Power of the Dog. Only problem is the big controversy of the night was Jane Campion, the director, when she won for best director. In her acceptance speech, she said something a little bit problematic. And you have to remember that one of the movies that was also up for awards was King Richard, which is the story of Venus and Serena Williams' father. And, of course, Venus and Serena were there, and she said, quote, "Serena and Venus, you are such marvels. However, you don't play against the guys like I have to." And she said it as kind of a joke, but, of course, they were taken aback by it in the audience. There was a shot of, I forget which one, they panned one of them, and her face was like, okay, you just said that. And, of course, immediately there was a backlash on Twitter, because what is Twitter for if it's not for having a backlash against everything? And here's the thing. Everyone's like, how dare you say that? It's about, look at all the sexism and racism they had to face. And I'm like, okay, whoa, pump the brakes a second. Before I say what I have to say and put my foot in my mouth, I give Campion credit that she came out and she immediately the next day apologized and tried to make better for what she said. I mean, she didn't sort of hedge and haw, and she didn't defend it. She's like, look, this cheesed people off. This was something that was probably very politically incorrect to say. So let's go into damage control immediately rather than trying to justify an off-the-cuff comment or something that she thought was funny that really didn't play. But I got to say this. She's not wrong. She's not wrong in the sense that Venus and Serena Williams play women's tennis. And that's the whole point she was making, is in women's tennis, they didn't have anything to overcome as women in women's tennis. Now, of course, they had to overcome their financial situation and their upbringing, the fact that they were black, and it's a very overwhelmingly white sport, and the privileged nature of tennis just on its own. And if you watch the movie King Richard, that really comes across about how difficult it is for anybody who's not independently wealthy, not just well off, not just privileged, but independently wealthy, very hard for them to do anything in tennis. So yes, Serena and Venus had to overcome all of that, but the fact that they're female had no bearing on their competition status because they're in female tennis. Now, of course, she is wrong in the sense to become a superstar and a media figure and to really capitalize on your fame as an athlete. You got to get endorsement deals and you got to have advertising appearances and you have to have notice and that sort of thing. And yes, absolutely, they had to fight against sexism there because they weren't just competing against other female tennis players. Like one of the Williams sisters, I forget which one, is in an ad for AT&T, I think, right now. Well, there's a reason that she's in there and not Tom Brady. You know, he's out there doing, you know, ads for something else. But the whole point is that's when they are competing against the men. So she is right, but she's also wrong. And with good reason, she came back and she apologized for what she said. She didn't deny she said it. But look, I think when you looked at the backlash, people are like, well, how dare you? You know, they had to fight as women. I'm like, well, not in women's tennis. You're in women's tennis. There's a very low threshold of requirement to just decide to do women's tennis, and that's to be a woman. Now, it'd be different if you're dealing with some of the trans issues that's going on with sports, but that has nothing to do with Venus and Serena Williams. So, not to completely defend Jane Campion, because she was wrong once you get outside of the very narrow purview of them being female tennis players, but she was not wrong in the sense that her as a director, she's always going up against guys. It's very rare for any movie to be like, well, we gotta have a female director for this. There is no female director category anywhere. She's going up against the men, mostly men. She's the only female director in the nominations for the Critics' Choice Award, as an example. The next piece of news I want to talk about really quickly is the box office for The Batman held strong. It was $66 million. That's, of course, not a big surprise because nothing came out last weekend in the theaters. Everything was online. Turning Red and The Adam Project. So, yes, it's a great hold for The Batman, but it's really easy to stay on top of the box office when nothing else comes out of its competition. I mean, the closest competition it has is Uncharted, which is down to less than $10 million. You know, that doesn't have the power of a superhero movie or the Batman franchise behind it. So that's good for the Batman, but this is not good for other movies. And even this week, there's not a whole lot coming out. So the Batman's, of course, going to rule. It's going to probably drop less than 50%, but that's because there's not a whole lot of choice in the marketplace right now. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first trailer I want to look at is for Sonic the Hedgehog 2, which is in theaters on April 8th.
What's happening?
Okay, quick version. Robotnik is back.
I discovered the source of ultimate power.
We need to get it back or the world is doomed.
You brought some kind of space porcupine.
I am an echidna warrior.
Hedgehog. It's time to say goodbye to humanity.
What's interesting about the Sonic movie is it was one of the last movies, not the last one, but it was one of the last movies that was released before the pandemic hit, before everything shut down back in the early days of 2020. And so here we are bookending the pandemic. Of course, I'm sure there's another variant that's going to be coming down the pike that's going to cause problems for everybody. But Sonic 2 is hoping to not get shut down by that. Sonic did pretty well for being, leading into the pandemic. And actually, I enjoyed the movie for what it is. This one looks like it's cut from the same cloth. They kept the more cartoonish and fun design of Sonic. So I'm glad that they're still emulating what you see in the game. But, hey, this looks cute. I thought the first one was a little bit of fun, so why not this one? I'm looking forward to this one. Apparently, I got a Saturday morning screening of that, which, I don't know, that's going to be tough to do just because I'm going to be in there with a bunch of kids. But I'm still looking forward to the movie. The next one I want to talk about is Puss in Boots: The Last Wish, which is in theaters on September 23rd.
The legend will never die!
I have bad news. You died, Doctor.
Relax! I am Puss in Boots!
I have 9 lives! And how many times have you died already?
I am not really a math guy.
4? That makes 8, Puss. What do you wish to do with your last life?
When you only have 1 life, that's what makes it special.
You know what? I liked the original Puss in Boots movie. I thought he was the best thing that came out of whatever, one of the Shrek movies. Well, if it was Shrek 2, I like Shrek 2. But I thought Puss in Boots has a better character base than the Shrek character. And it's surprising it took him so long to make a sequel to this, because the first Puss in Boots I actually thought was a fun little movie. This one looks like it's kind of cool. It's actually based, in a weird way on a weird Tales from the Crypt episode, which is based on a comic book in the horror genre back in the 50s. But I don't think that they meant to do that. Anyways, Puss in Boots, The Last Wish. That looks like it might be a lot of fun too. So I'm looking forward to that. And that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Panama and Master.
Because we can!
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's start off with the movie reviews and talk about Panama. A down-on-his-luck veteran in the 80s is hired to negotiate a deal with warring factions in Central America.
Panama's about to explode.
This is where I come in to clean it up. If there's ever a guy needed for a tough job, this was him, Becker.
He might go rogue, and I don't want that blood on my hands.
There are some friends of Uncle Sam looking for creative ways to fund Contras. The first order of business, buy a chopper. Contras want the chopper in return. They'll give us weaponry and intel.
So question for you. Yeah. So legal?
Sure.
This movie feels like it should have been made when it took place. Because it stars Mel Gibson. Mel Gibson is not the mercenary or the veteran who goes, that's Cole Hauser. Now, if you don't know who Cole Hauser is, Wings Hauser is more the contemporary of Mel Gibson doing action movies in the 80s and leaning into the 90s. Cole Hauser's his son, and he's done some movies and TV. You might recognize him and stuff, but he still to me feels like he's sort of he's one of those that you expect all of his movies to end up on riff tracks at some point. And the big connection between Mel Gibson and Cole Hauser is he starred in the Mel Gibson produced film Paparazzi, which is his follow up to The Passion of the Christ. I think it might have been Passion of the Christ follow up, but he was a star who was being harassed by photojournalists and that sort of thing, which, of course, you know, struck home with Mel Gibson. And this is right before Mel Gibson's sort of image started to really deteriorate. This is also directed by Mark Neveldine, who is the one half of Neveldine and Taylor. They're the guys who directed movies like Crank. That's what they're probably best known for. They did Crank. They wrote Jonah Hex. They directed Gamer, if you remember that movie with Gerard Butler and Michael C. Hall back in like 2008, 2009. They're known for very gritty, on-the-fly, run-and-gun action thrillers. But the two of them together kind of had a kismet that worked in something like Crank, which of course was the Jason Statham movie where he's trying to keep himself alive by dosing himself with adrenaline. But it seems that Neveldine, when he doesn't have his friend Brian Taylor with him, he's not as good. I mean, you can see him having the desire to do the run and gun action film, but it seems like he's trying to do that guerrilla fighting, the bad guys, drug dealers, super rich people in Central America type movie, the kind of thing you would have seen with Chuck Norris back in the 80s. And I don't know, the movie itself, like I said, it feels like it's steeped in the 80s, and it is. And it feels like it wants to be an 80s thriller. It feels like it's trying to be that, but it's just failing miserably at each step of the path. And Mel Gibson's okay. And actually, Mel Gibson's the best part of it because, you know, he just turns on his Mel Gibson mode and at least he's watchable. You may not like him as a person, but at least you can watch him and accept him. And it seems to work with what he does. But Cole Hauser is just awful in this movie. He's just boring. And there's nothing to him, and he's kind of out of shape. He's not as big as I am. He's a little bit chubby. And it has every single cliche. It has the drug dealers in Panama, the connections to Noriega, and it's trying to tell this story of how the U.S. government hired mercenaries to basically pull this thing off because they didn't want them. They needed like a Soviet helicopter. I mean, it's this convoluted story that really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And that's okay because what was going on in Panama back in the 80s, especially the late 80s, was very convoluted and it was kind of a mess for anyone to really understand because there were so many people at play and so many factions happening. You know, sort of like what's going on in the Middle East. There's so many different groups and little pieces here and there that it's kind of hard to keep track of them all if you're not from the area. But the problem is, it's just boring. And at a certain point, I didn't know who I was supposed to be rooting for. Was I supposed to be rooting for this guy, or was I supposed to be wanting him to completely fall apart and fail because he was such an unlikable character? I know this movie itself, it tries. It really tries hard. And at times, it tries too much that it's laughable. Yeah, this movie's terrible. I was hoping that it would at least be watchable with a little bit of Mel Gibson flair to it, but it didn't even have that. So I'm going to have to say Panama sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Master. An African-American girl faces danger when she starts college only to discover her dorm room might be haunted.
Guys, she got the room.
Legends.
Ancaster College is crowded with them. When you go to a school that's nearly as old as the country, you can expect to hear a few.
It can be really hard for students of color. Just know I'm here.
It's amazing, Gil. First black master.
It's very exciting.
It is.
The whole school's cursed.
Okay, you're gonna have to try a lot harder than that to scare me.
Seriously, it's real.
This is a Prime Video release, so I believe it's on Prime this weekend. It's also hitting theaters. And it stars Regina Hall. She plays, well, the title Masters, referring to her, because she's in charge of division of this college. And it's a very old, privileged college. And the problem with this movie, it doesn't know what it's trying to do. On one hand, it's telling the story about this girl who's going to school, who's this other character, not Regina Hall. And she comes from, like, Tacoma, Washington, so she kind of comes from the suburbs. And there are all these privileged white kids she's dealing with, and they act like they've never seen or even talked to a black person in their life. And I'm watching this thing going, my God, I went to college in the 90s, and there were plenty of black people in college. I mean, it was like she shows up on campus, and everyone, the record stops, and everyone looks over, and they're like, what, there's a black kid on campus? I'm like, what? And then you start watching the movie and be like, nope, somebody's using an iPhone, so this must be modern day. And I could see that thing happening in the 60s or 70s, even in the 90s, to a very, very tight-knit, family-oriented legacy college. But my God, this just doesn't make any sense watching it now in 2022. So it feels like whoever's putting this together is doing it about their days, like maybe back in the 70s, 80s, or 90s. But the other thing on top of it is it tries to make these deft political points. Like they have one character who's a black teacher and she's going through tenure. And all that does is just completely distract from this, ultimately this supposed haunting that's going on to the girl. The haunting section is okay, but it's a very, very thinly and not very well veiled, allegory to a girl going to college and having to deal with, you know, extreme privilege, which is weird because I'm assuming if you grew up in Tacoma, you probably had your fair share of running into privileged people as well. I don't know what position this is coming from, and I don't know what era it was written in, even though it seems to take place today. And every single racial point they try to make is overly heavy-handed and over the top. It's not like Panama, where Panama just didn't make sense. This one makes too much sense. In fact, it beats you over the head with the sense it's trying to make. It's really trying to make a political point, and you're like, I get it. You do this person as an analogy to this person. She's analogous to this character we've seen in the news. It's trying to bring up the idea of institutionalized racism, but with a progressive veneer to it. And again, that's not new, but it's you can make that point. And I think that point is out there to be made. But, oh my God, this thing, in a lot of ways, just hammers it home too hard. It's so obvious. You know, this is the equivalent of Jimmy Fallon on Saturday Night Live laughing at his own jokes. It's not funny, and it breaks the mood. So this one was also pretty terrible. So I'm going to have to say Master sucks as well.
It sucks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Outfit and the last days of Ptolemy Gray. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about The Outfit. A Chicago tailor struggles to stay alive when a group of gangsters threaten his business and safety.
Do we let all of our customers keep black boxes in back?
If we only allowed angels to be customers, soon we'd have no customers at all. Please, sir, I don't want any trouble.
I need you to listen carefully. There are 1,000 blue boys out there hunting for this. And if they find it, I start shooting, you follow? Making matters worse, there are 1,000 racket boys hunting for it too. And if they find it, they start shooting, you follow?
Don't want to be involved in whatever it is you do.
This movie came out of nowhere because right now everything is just kind of clearing the way for the Batman to continue. And what is it, the third, fourth week the Batman's been in theaters? But there's nothing really big on the schedule. And then this one kind of just showed up out of nowhere. And I asked for a screener, and it kind of came like at the last minute, and I watched it. As you can tell, after my last segment, this came after a week of watching some pretty terrible movies, some movies that I just did not like. And so I started watching The Outfit, and I gotta say, this movie really impressed me. I really loved it. I mean, first of all, it stars Mark Rylance, and sometimes an actor has no control over whether a movie's any good, but pretty much you know if Mark Rylance is showing up in something, at least his performance is going to be good. And he plays this very soft-spoken, almost the man who wasn't there. If you remember that movie with the Coen brothers with Billy Bob Thornton as a barber? This one is where he's this tailor, and he works. It's like in 1940s Chicago, and gangsters use his place as a cash drop and stuff, and people come and go, but he doesn't. He looks the other way. He doesn't question them. He just does what he needs to do, and he's like, you can do that as long as you don't bother me. And so he has a relatively good relationship with them. But then there's something that goes wrong, and two of them show up at his place, and one of them shot, and he's kind of put in a position where he's got to help them out, but then he's threatened, and he's here trying to keep himself alive, keep them from destroying his business, keep them from, you know, even killing the people who work for him. He's trying to manipulate the situation, and he's very good at it, but he's very soft-spoken, he's very quiet, he's very friendly. But it's a real lesson in tense direction and tension in general. The movie itself takes place almost completely in one room. I mean, there's just, it's all takes place almost completely in the tailor shop itself, except for like one scene right at the beginning and the end, you see somebody come and go. The rest of it, there's like two or three rooms in the tailor shop, and the entire movie takes place in there. It's very much a talking film. If you remember the film Rope with James Stewart, it was a Hitchcock movie. Now, that had the catch of trying to do like all a one-shot type thing, so that was the gimmick in that movie. But because they were doing that kind of a gimmick in the 50s, it necessitated it all to be in one room. And sometimes those one-room movies can be boring, but sometimes those one-room movies can be really, really well done. It also kind of reminds me a little bit of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, although there's more to that movie, but there's a whole lot of that takes place in the basement of this club. And that's the same thing here. It's just sort of this small little shop, and you got people coming and going, and you can see him trying to manipulate the situation to try and keep himself safe, because he's at times in a no-win situation. He's at times his back's up against a wall, and no matter what he does, you know, it's going to result in his death or something worse. So it's very tense, brilliantly acted by Mark Rylance, and just really effectively written. I mean, it just comes down to being just a well-made film. I don't know if it's based on a play, but it could have been. It certainly feels like a play where it all, like I said, takes place. And it's not a gangster movie in the sense where you get a big shoot 'em up. You know, I mean, you think a gangster movie, it's not like The Untouchables or something like that. It's not The Godfather. You know, it's not this sweeping story of a crime family like The Godfather was. It's also not a run and gun kind of violent. It has some violence in it, but it's not the keep going violence that you saw in, you know, movies like Goodfellas or as I mentioned, The Untouchables. It's just a very densely written, but very tightly and perfectly done and executed film. And so I really enjoyed it. I'm going to have to say, if you get a chance, if you're going to go to the theater, skip Batman and go see this one, because The Outfit totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Last Days of Ptolemy Gray. Samuel L. Jackson stars as an aging man with dementia who agrees to an experimental procedure in order to regain his memories so he can discover his nephew's killer.
Reggie, I'm old.
And I seem like I can't remember nothing no more.
So you want me to take you to that special doctor? One that might could help you remember things.
We developed a treatment. Mr. Gray will remember everything that he has ever known. But the treatment will only work once.
Is that what you want?
I got a lot of things to do. And I need my memory to do it.
This is a series, actually. It's not a movie. It's a series on Apple TV Plus. And I believe it dropped, at least the first episodes dropped last week, and they got a new episode this week, and that's how Apple TV Plus does it. They do the Amazon route, or the Hulu route, where they'll drop two or three episodes right at the beginning, and then they drop a new episode each week, and that sort of strings you along so you can keep watching, rather than the Netflix approach of just putting everything out there and letting you binge watch an entire series over the weekend. Now, I think Samuel L. Jackson's brilliant in this because it actually gives him a chance to act. One of the problems when you're somebody like Samuel L. Jackson, you're like Jack Nicholson. You know, you have a stock character, a stock role that you're expected to play in everything, single thing you do. If you're not playing Nick Fury, you're playing the guy from Snakes on a Plane. You're essentially limited. You end up typecasting yourself in such a way that you're so distinctive, they only get you for those kind of roles. But this reminds you, Samuel L. Jackson's actually a really good actor. And I haven't seen him really throw down acting like this since Resurrecting the Champ, which was, gosh, a dozen or so years ago. And this gives him a chance to actually play different depths of a character. Now, the story is about a guy, he's got dementia, and he just lives in squalor, and he's an absolute mess. He can barely take care of himself. His apartment is a wreck. He's a hoarder. And he doesn't remember what's going on from day to day. And he has this nephew that comes and helps him periodically, who kind of keeps him safe, helps him to cash his checks, pay his bills, that sort of thing. And the guy shows up murdered. Then they have this sort of experimental treatment that allows him to gain his memory back, sort of like a Flowers for Algernon sort of thing, where instead of dealing with mental retardation, you're dealing with loss of memories. You're dealing with the cognitive issues that a lot of old people do. And with an aging population, this has become more and more common. And if you noticed over the last, I'd say after the last 5-10 years, there have been more and more movies made about this. You remember the movie Supernova with Stanley Tucci dealt with cognitive issues or losing Alice or Still Alice. What was that one with Julianne Moore? You see this being dealt with a lot because I think a lot of people are dealing with this more and more because you're able to keep people alive, but then their cognitive issues become more and more pronounced as they get older. And all that's fine. The problem I have with this is such a punishing, heavy, drab show. It's all sepia-toned, and it feels unwashed. You know what I mean? Like when you have like an undershirt, and you just wear it, and you sweat in it too much, and it gets that dingy, gray, almost yellow color. That's the imagery that's evoked with the cinematography on this show. And while there's a fantastic performance by Samuel L. Jackson, it's everyone else in the series is just a horrible person, and it's just punishing to watch. And yeah, things can pick up as it goes on, but and then on top of it, it has this whole idea where they're like, oh, we can help you remember everything, which kind of feels almost like a science fiction trope more than pragmatic stuff that actually is happening. So yeah, the science fiction angle to it, it just seems it's too perfect of fix. It's like, oh, well, even if you watch something like Severance, which has this thing where they can separate your memories, you're like, okay, I can see where you had that piece of technology, you can expound past that, but they're just like, oh, we have this magical pill or this injection. I didn't buy it, and it was tough to watch. It was exhausting to watch. So I'm going to have to say The Last Days of Ptolemy Gray, in spite of a great performance by Samuel L. Jackson, it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Deep Water and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Nightmare.
Stop it now.
Welcome back to Fekai's at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the movie reviews and talk about Deep Water. Ben Affleck and Ana de Armas star as a couple who have fallen out of love and find themselves falling into destructive behavior.
Why is mom so different around other people?
The fact that she's comfortable flaunting all these relationships around all of us, you're better than that.
She's different. That's what I like about her.
I want to feel joy in my life.
You want to tell me why you didn't come home last night?
Not really.
This isn't a game, Melinda.
It's always been a game.
This is one of those movies that is more famous for what happened from the movie than the movie itself. This movie stars Ben Affleck and Ana de Armas. And they made news because they became a couple. They met on this movie and they started fooling around and they broke up. You know, what Ben Affleck tends to do, he tends to burn through his co-stars. You know, he did that with Jennifer Lopez. He did it with Jennifer Garner. And while those were longer relationships, each one, and now he's back with Jennifer Lopez, he's known for being with the woman that he's paired with. Didn't he date Gwyneth Paltrow in the 90s or something like that? No, this is a Ben Affleck thing, and that's okay. I mean, look, that's not a male or female thing because Helena Bonham Carter's done plenty herself. You know, so then we famously broke up, and there's this wonderful picture on the internet of, and I don't think it's Ben Affleck doing it. I think he just had some worker there, but they were getting rid of stuff, and they have a picture of his a trash bin, and they're throwing away this cardboard cutout of Ana de Armas. And she's adorable. She's gorgeous. She's a beautiful woman. And she also does a lot of nude scenes. If you've ever seen Knock Knock, you know, or even, what was it, Hands of Stone? You know, a lot of people really kind of took a notice of her when she was in Knives Out because she was the nice, sweet little demure nurse who worked for them. And then, of course, she was this, you know, kind of goofy, little bit of a flibbertigibbet spy in No Time to Die. She was the most lighthearted, fun part of that movie, actually. And she's got real charisma on screen. I don't know what she's like in real life. I'm sure she's perfectly nice, you know, but so whatever, they broke up. And so I knew this movie was coming out, and then it's on Hulu. And so it's coming up, and I'm interested in it, but I don't know anything about it. Certainly didn't read a synopsis. I didn't even read sort of like what the general idea was. And I like doing that. I like sometimes getting a movie and pressing play and not knowing anything about it. And sometimes it's off-putting because you're like, is this going to be a horror movie? Is this a movie where magic happens? Or is this a movie about, you know, a family, you know, just going through a kitchen sink drama? As I'm watching the movie, I'm like, oh, okay, this feels like something Adrian Lyne would have directed in the 80s or 90s. He directed Fatal Attraction. He directed Indecent Proposal. He most recently had done Unfaithful, which was like in 2002. And he did the remake of Lolita with Jeremy Irons, which I think was a Showtime movie. So he's dealt with sort of that erotic thriller and sex in movies and all that kind of thing. And then I just happened to look up, I'm curious as to who directed it. And guess who directed it? It's Adrian Lyne. And I was like, say what you want to about him as a director. This definitely plays to the auteur theory that you can direct a movie and it's going to feel like your work, even if you aren't able to know what it is. So it certainly felt like an Adrian Lyne movie. But you got to realize, I'm not a huge fan of his stuff. Oh, yeah, Fatal Attraction was cool, and that was sort of the talked about movie of the day. I thought Indecent Proposal was an absolute piece of garbage. And doesn't even make internal sense when you watch the movie. It was just all for that would you sleep with somebody for $1 million story. But he did kind of have a corner on that erotic thriller market. And so I was like, oh, okay, maybe this will be an erotic thriller. And of course, it's listed as an erotic thriller. But here's the problem. This erotic thriller is short on thrills and eroticism. And so I don't know what the point of it is then. It's about this couple, and you can tell that their relationship is imploding. And she is clearly having affairs, and you don't get any sort of backstory. So the assumption is that he's okay with it. They either have an open marriage or something. But as it goes on, you're like, well, he's okay with it just because he knows he can't stop her. And then, of course, he's threatening violence to people. But is he really threatening violence, or is he joking? And that's kind of, I guess, part of the mystery is he actually a violent person, or is he just trying to intimidate somebody? And does it answer that? I guess yes, maybe, kind of. And even then, it's unclear. And, you know, it's all supposed to be how, you know, one has to be smarter than the other, but they do some really stupid things, both of them. And, oh, yeah, you get to see her naked. That's great. That's, like, the best part about the movie. The rest of it is it's just boring. Nothing happens. So this is another one I didn't like. I'm going to have to say that Deep Water sucked.
It sucks.
You're listening to Feckeyes at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That song means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is going to be on Nightmare. This is another one from Shout Factory. It's an old Hammer film. I love these movies. I love digging in and finding some of these older, sometimes even more obscure films that either people forget about, something from the 60s, 50s. But Nightmare just recently came out on Blu-ray. And in this film, a teenager suffers from the fear that she will go insane like her mother, sending her down the road of violence and murder.
You found me out there, didn't you? That part of it wasn't a dream. Why does the dream finish and reality begin?
Are you dreaming, Janet? Are you sleeping? Or is this a waking nightmare?
What do you mean by locking yourself in all day?
I'll tell you. Here, I'm safe. I don't have to worry about anybody sneaking up behind me with this.
What is it? A nightmare or cold-blooded murder?
A lot of people saying it's kind of a takeoff on Diabolique, post-noir and skullduggery type movie. This one's in black and white. And it's directed by Freddie Francis, who he's best known for doing some of the Hammer and Amicus films, you know, stuff like Tales from the Crypt. And I'm a big Freddie Francis fan. I think it's his stuff. Well, he's a great cinematographer, actually. He did the cinematography for the original Dune. And, you know, he's done a lot of big stuff. But he also directed a bunch of these British films that were these somewhat modest thrillers and horror stories. You know, I'm a big fan of Hammer and Amicus. The story is kind of in two parts, and it's made in the early 60s. It's 1964 is when this came out. So this was at a time where it was very popular, these pretty girl going insane movies is the best way I can approach that. Like, for example, Psycho, even though that doesn't completely fall into that category, it is that homicidal, murdering kind of thing that these young blonde women are in danger of. And that's what you got with Psycho. You also had that in the Psycho knockoff Homicidal by William Castle. And, you know, Nightmare falls right in. And I talked about the movie Paranoiac about a month or two ago. That's also, I believe, that was directed by Freddie Francis, and it feels very similar to this one, where you have, you know, these murders or these bad things happening, and there's you know, a rich family involved, and you got to figure out what's going on. The big thing with this one is it has this weird little shift in the story and shift in the characters. It's kind of in two parts, not the way the Batman is, where it's spending 3 hours to do it. But it's sort of like the first act of the movie is almost like its own movie itself, and then the second and third act is a new movie. But I mean, the movie itself is only an hour and a half long, so it's kind of these two stories crammed together. And the neat thing about it is it has these secrets that get revealed like within the first half of the film. And that's kind of cool. And that's why, I mean, that's sort of like the beats you get when I'm saying it tells its own story. It kind of reveals these plot twists in the first half of the film. And then the second half has its own, you know, little, mystery structure. So it's an interesting film to watch. It moves pretty quickly, and it's interesting to try and figure out, because it seems like it's predictable at times, but at times it's really not as predictable as you think it is going in. So I'm going to say I really enjoyed it. And, you know, the Shout Factory Blu-ray comes with a whole bunch of different things. A lot of good stuff. They got an audio commentary. And most of the stuff, the commentary and the behind the scenes stuff, a lot of this stuff involves film historians, because, I mean, this thing was made in 1964. A lot of the people involved in this are no longer with us. And that's okay, but they do have a bunch of background, and they dug up some of the actors or some of the interviews with some of the actors who are no longer able to do it. But, you know, it's mostly retrospectives and not first-person responses when it comes to the bonus material. But still, we're a movie worth checking out if you've never seen it, if you like that sort of Hammer film setup. I'm going to say Nightmare kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Also available this week, we've got West Side Story available on Blu-ray and 4K, The Boy Behind the Door, and new releases of The Sword and the Sorcerer, The Accused, and Touch of Evil getting a 4K release. And that's it. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about The Lost City. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.